I'm Greg Johnson.
I'm John Morgan.
And I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back for another one of our weekly roundtables. And as usual, I want to begin by thanking our donors. This year, we are trying to raise $100,000, and we have raised $45,176.92. That 92 cents has been around for a long time. So I hope somebody in coming days will donate something like $1,000.08 so we can just have nice round figures from now on. We've had four donations since our last update. RF gave $200, DF 100, DR 100, and KT 100, all very generous. So thank you all very much for that support. And we are going to continue this fundraiser really until we reach our goal or the end of the calendar year, whichever comes first.
Thanks, everybody. We really value your help.
Very good. Yes. Yes. I think it's encouraging to see how many people contribute to nationalist causes and show solidarity on those things.
Yeah, and one thing that's happened recently is we have been somewhat crippled in our fundraising capacities because of another deplatforming, which has left us with the ability to take credit card donations only from the United States. But we're working on that. There are many, many options available out there that we're searching for, and we hope to be up and running with some kind of global credit card processing again in the future. Frankly, there are so many different banks out there, including banks in parts of the world that don't really care about what the ADL or the SPLC has to say about us, that eventually we're going to get ourselves up and running again. It's just a matter of time, and those of you who have been helping us out during this lean time deserve an especial thanks, because you're helping us lay the groundwork for a more stable platform in the future. Of course, there is no permanent solution to any of these problems, and we have just got to get used to being deplatformed. And we have to get to the point where we can just open up a file and go to the next option, right? Open up a file and plug in all the data that we gathered for the last round of applications and try and get another processor, another bank, whatever, another website provider. There are lots of options in the world still. Globalization hasn't destroyed our options. There's not one big bank. There's not one big internet provider, thank God, or we would be in a very bad state. So anyway, thank you again, and we will continue with these updates weekly. This week, we are going to keep a promise we made in our last podcast, which is to talk to Frody about the Scanza Forum. There are two Scanza Forum events coming up. You heard breaking news last week about one coming up in Oslo. There's also one coming up in Copenhagen. So Frody, why don't you tell us first about the Copenhagen event, and then we can go into Oslo, and then we can dig into the history of the Scanza Forum a bit.
Right, yeah. So the first event that's coming up is in Copenhagen, Denmark, on October 12th, and we're going to do an event about national populism. Now, national populism has become especially relevant over the last few years because a book was published last year by Goodwin and Eatwell on national populism, and they write in the foreword to that book that they decided to write it in 2016 because of two major events that sort of made them question the great narrative of how things are going, generally speaking, in politics in the West. And those two things were the election of Donald Trump and his announcement to as a presidential candidate. And the other thing is Brexit. Both of those things were very much treated by a monolithic mass media and establishment that were hostile to those two things. But the interesting thing is that the populations of both America and of Britain went against the will of the elites and went against the mass media establishment's narrative and still elected Donald Trump and voted to get out of the EU. And those are interesting things. And also, there's a trend in Europe that big national populist parties are getting more and more votes in spite of being treated in a very hostile way by the mass media and really not painted as serious candidates, still people are voting for them. Now, those people might not be white nationalists, all of them, but going against the mass media narrative is the first step, definitely. And we're going to talk about some of those big trends in Copenhagen on October 12th. And the speakers are myself and Greg. Greg has spoken at every Skanza forum. He is our regular speaker. Rasmus Paludan, who is a Danish defense attorney and politician and a bit of a showman. Now, he runs a party called Stram Kurs, which is roughly in English, hard line, which is basically a hard line party on expelling immigrants from Denmark who are not compatible with Danish society. And he announced not very long before the Danish parliamentary elections earlier this summer in June, in the beginning of June, he announced his candidacy just shortly before that, and still he got 1.8% of the votes. And the cutoff to get into the Danish parliament is 2%. So he was very close. And we have to keep in mind that Denmark already has two national populist parties in parliament. Well, one of them got in during this last election as well. So the first one is, of course, Dansk Folkeparti, which has been in parliament for a long time and is well known. And the other one is Nye Borgerlige, which also came in now, and the third one was then Rasmus Paludan's, which is probably the most radical of the three, and he is well known on YouTube as well. So this is an interesting dynamic in Denmark going on, and that's why I thought it was a relevant topic to be talking about in that country and in Copenhagen. Because what Rasmus Paludan does is he goes to these immigrant areas in Copenhagen, he brings a camera with him, and then he confronts Muslims, basically, and has frank discussions with them and questions the way they are not really compatible, that their values are not compatible with the Danish society and so on. And what inevitably happens is that they become hostile to him and want to attack him. And the result from this has been that he has death threats from Muslims and he has to have security service protection when he moves around.
We should include a link to a couple of these videos in the show notes.
Cause yeah.
When you showed them to me, I thought they were quite... some of them are quite amusing, actually. I mean, he really doesn't care at all what anybody thinks of him. He just marches into these areas and gets into it.
Exactly. Seeing is believing, right? So, I mean, you can tell the story of how bad things are. But if the mass media shows you a very sort of rosy picture of everything being very happy in this multicultural society, and him showing you, oh, well, this is the reality if I go out there and actually take this discussion with them, that is effective. And some of his videos have over 1 million views. And in a country like Denmark that has 5 million people in total, that's a quite substantial amount. So that's going to be good. He's a very intelligent guy, very, very eloquent, and it's good. It will be good to have him on our stage. Millennial Woes will speak as well. This is his fourth time on the Skanza Forum stage. His speeches are always very appreciated. I think actually his first speech in July 1st in the summer of 2017 in Oslo is probably the best speech I've seen by him, and that's very good to have him on board there. Mark Collett is going to speak as well. Now, I was on Mark Collett's show last night to announce these upcoming events and so on. And he has a huge YouTube channel, and he has been active in nationalism for a couple of decades. He was involved in the BNP a couple of decades ago. So he's a veteran, I think it's fair to say. And when he spoke in Stockholm earlier this year, his speech was very much appreciated by people there. It was very inspiring, and he carries the British tradition of oratory, sort of inspiring oratory. He does that very well. Now that's the event in Copenhagen. You want me to go on to the...
Yeah, let's talk about it. Well, I guess maybe we should say a few things, and we'll put these in the show notes too, but what should people do if they want to attend in Copenhagen, because that's coming up relatively soon. People should start planning for it.
Yes. I mean, we do get visitors from all over. Some, you know, people have flown in from Asia, from Canada.
South America. From South America. United States, yeah.
The United States. So people are coming from all over to visit these events in Scandinavia. And I'm very proud of that, and I'm very happy about it, because we do get lots of very good people. And I always, you know, get to know new people at these events. And that's the major benefit of them. I mean, the information is there and you can read about the information. But the major benefit is, you know, get top quality people gathered in one place and you can network, and things are born out of that. Now, if you want to attend, we have a vetting process. So the first thing you do is you send them an email. And I want you to include two things in that email. The first thing is that since we have two events coming up in the near future, I need to know which one of the two events you want to attend. So let me know if it's Copenhagen or Oslo, or both. I mean, of course, you're welcome to register both. And then we have a vetting process. And that's basically for your safety, for the integrity of the event, and for the safety of the participants and speakers. So there are three ways you can get admitted, and you need to include that as well. That's the second thing we need. The first way is if you've been at our event for earlier, and just make a note of that so I know which event, and I can check that's true and so on, and that will get you admitted. The second thing is if you haven't been to our events earlier, but you know someone who has, or if you know someone else who can vouch for you, some person that I know and trust who can vouch for you, that just say that, you know, I know this person, he or she wants to attend with honest intentions, so I can recommend that person. That's fine. If you don't know anyone, if you haven't been there before, the third option is to send me photo ID, because this thing is built on trust. And if I trust you to enough to admit you to my event and among other people, you have to trust me with your identity. I have to know who you are. And I think that's fair.
That's wise, yeah. A lot of the infiltrators that have happened in recent years, I can't think of a single example of an infiltrator who couldn't have been stopped just by asking for photo ID.
Yeah.
Patrick Hermanson, when I met him in London and sat down to talk with him, if I had just asked for his photo ID, he couldn't have presented me with an ID.
Yeah.
With the name that he was going under. It would have ended it right there.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a very simple thing that we can do. If there's some question, some doubt about a person's identity and their sincerity. One thing that has occurred to me in the past is the following. When in 2017, when I went to the London Forum and the Jonathan Bowden dinner, where we had this infiltrator who was there, Hermanson, there was also a journalist there, a bona fide journalist who's written for Newsweek and other publications, a Canadian living in the UK, who came there under no false pretenses, openly identified herself as a journalist to the organizers. She was identified as a journalist to people that she spoke to. She was going to basically follow ethical reporting procedures and things like that. And in fact, she did. And she didn't present any problems. There was no doxing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about admitting journalists to these events if they're identified as such, maybe with like a yellow badge that says press or something like that on it?
I personally don't have a problem with it. And I'm also, you know, a semi-public figure in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to make from case to case evaluation. Because, you know, I would have to look at, have they done serious work in the past?
Right.
Are these serious people? Is it credible to me that they will follow ethical rules when dealing with this? Or
right.
Will they, you know?
I mean, if they have a long history of writing smears for BuzzFeed and things like that, they don't have a chance. But
no.
You know, if somebody's a serious writer. And one of the reasons why it's at least reasonable, I think, to for some of our groups to do this, is that it takes the wind out of the sails of the infiltrators.
Yeah, yeah.
The people who say, oh, I snuck in and discovered that they say in private what they say in public.
Yeah.
Right? And, oh, I was so courageous. It's like, yeah. Wait a sec. There was like an actual journalist from Newsweek here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what are you claiming exactly?
Exactly.
Basically, you were being an unethical journalist when you could have just been an ethical journalist.
Exactly, and I do think that, you know, one of my talking points is always normalization.
Right.
And that's basically a self-image. If you have two options. Either you go into the hostile narrative from hostile parties that we are some sort of weirdos, that we have to stay on the margins, or you just see yourself as a person who should be taken seriously as anyone else.
Right.
And the only natural thing would be that when our ideas become more and more popular, I mean, this is also in line with national populism, because more and more people are just accepting that this is how things are.
Mm-hmm.
We have to expect that even journalists will take us seriously and will talk to us on an honest foundation with honest intentions. And I think we have to be open to that.
Yeah,
and if I get signals from a journalist that he or she has honest intentions, I don't see why I should exclude them, as long as I make that clear to my participants.
Exactly. So
there is a journalist here, but they have, you know, signed a document that they will stay to these ethical rules. Then I think it's fine to have them.
Yeah, and Jared Taylor has journalists like that at the American Renaissance conferences, for instance. They're clearly identified as such, and they, I think so far, have, well, put it this way, I haven't heard of any of them who've behaved improperly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is part of our normalization strategy, I think, to have people like this, if they actually behave in a creditable way.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it does really undermine the pretense of infiltrators. If you sneaked in under false pretenses, when you could have come under open pretenses, legitimately, you sneaked in under false pretenses, and yet you expect us to think that you're not lying.
Yeah.
In your write-up of the event, right? It just doesn't make any sense. It's almost a performative contradiction. You know, I lied to all these people, and now I'm going to tell you the truth.
Right? Yeah, and exactly, and what they do, what they inevitably do is, you know, because what we say in public is what we say in private, because the whole point of this movement, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that I don't want to continue being part of this society that's pretending all the time. We're pretending things to be a way it isn't. So right. One of my major motivations for you know, doing what I do is that I have the freedom to speak what I actually believe.
Right.
And the only thing that an undercover journalist can do is to just repeat the same things I say in public, but just then add like horror film music in the background,
right?
To make it sound weird, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I had a conversation with somebody who said, "Greg, what do you have to offer people? I mean, you talk about white extinction and genocide and all this gloomy stuff. What do you have to offer? I mean, short of stopping all these horrible things.
Yeah.
But in the short run, what do you have to offer? I guess that was really the question. And the answer I give is that people don't have to live by lies.
Mm-hmm.
Live not by lies.
Yeah.
That's a positive thing
mm-hmm.
that people can begin to do today.
Yeah.
And it's immensely freeing.
It is. I mean, and the second thing is, well, that's the first thing. You don't have to live by lies. And the second thing, on short term, because, of course, the long term is, you know, if our ideas win, in the end, we get a better society for everyone. And that's of course, a long-term benefit. But in the short term, you get to be a part of this family or whatever. Because I can feel the sort of immense freedom of I can travel basically everywhere and I know people there and I can just hang out with them and I don't have to hang out with people who seem insane to me because mm-hmm. they just feel that they have to lie all the time. Mm-hmm. So this sort of networking, getting to know other good people that you can just relax and you know, have a normal life interacting with these people, that is one of the major benefits, and that's immediate. Because you can just you know, reap those benefits immediately, because when you get to know people, you start hanging out with them, and basically you're starting to build this, I wouldn't say parallel life, but you're building basically a structured network, social networks that are sort of parallel to this weird society where you just continue your normal life, but then you hang out with people and you can just talk freely about things, and it's a mentally and intellectually relaxing thing to do where you can just be yourself among other people, and that's a major benefit.
Yeah, I like this little phrase that if you're fighting for the golden age, you sort of get to live in it today.
Yeah.
Now, there are lots of things in this broader movement that could contradict that. I mean, the crazed online culture and stuff like that, that can be pretty discouraging and unpleasant, but the truth of the matter is that on balance, you, I think, have a better life by being around people who are authentic.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain amount of discretion
yeah.
about who you associate with and things like that. But if you exercise due caution, and believe me, you've got to exercise due caution in all areas of your life anyway,
yes.
right? If you exercise a little discrimination and don't hang out with people who give off weird vibes that make you uncomfortable, chances are being involved in the movement is going to make your life better rather than worse.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And, you know, someone might object that, well, you have to think about bigger society and everything. Sure, I mean, we have a responsibility for the society we live in, even if it's not our fault that things turned out this way because we didn't have power, so we didn't create the situation. But yeah. we still have a responsibility to set it right for future generations or whatever. But I mean, if you just look at your own life, no matter what society you live in, you don't interact with everyone in that society, like millions of people. You normally interact with a quite limited number of people. And when you start networking with other people of, you know, similar sensibilities and so on, well, that your little private life can be very much what you want it to be even before society has changed in the larger sense.
It's sort of a micro community.
Yeah, it is.
You can join and, well, for me, you know, I mean, I was sympathetic to these ideas for years before I actually became, you know, directly involved in any way, but just psychologically, I felt so much better after, because you know, you're around people that you don't have to conceal what you actually think or
yeah.
pretend to be somebody you're not. You can just be yourself, and there's enormous value in that. Especially, I think, for people who are too wrapped up in social media, because you need to interact with people in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of the value of your events.
Of course.
Is you get to actually be with a person and not just responding to somebody, you know, hiding under, you know, like Odin 88, on Twitter or something like that. You're actually engaging with real people who are very dedicated. And I've met, well, Greg and I like to say, you know, we've met some of the best people and also some of the worst people in this thing. But I definitely think at these events, I meet more of the best people.
Definitely.
And it really gives you hope and confidence in the future when you see that there's other people like you, other competent people,
yeah.
other people with similar interests and so forth who are in the exact same situation as you. There's a lot of value in that.
Exactly. And one of my sort of major talking points that I always repeat is that, you know, people are, to a limited extent, rational creatures who, you know, calculate facts and logic and everything. But first and foremost, they are social creatures. And even, you know, scientists, major scientists who have devoted their life to something, you know, James Watson comes to mind. You know, scientists are usually introverts, not very social, but they still need social confirmation, because even people who have sort of devoted their lives to research on something and then they just, you know, tell the truth as they see it, when they get pressured socially, even they break. You know, they know that they know this subject 100 times better than whatever sort of average Joe journalist who criticizes them does. But still, they have to back down because otherwise their social life is in ruins.
Mm-hmm.
And when you actually have a different social life around you, you don't have that weakness.
Yeah, and people who are transitioning from one world to the other, people who have normie lives and who take a courageous stand for some reason, and suddenly the enemy is coming after them with knives out and people are afraid to be seen with them and so forth, they always think of the friends they're losing and they never think of maybe the friends they might gain if they just stand up for themselves. And that's natural. You always think of the bird in the hand, right, that's trying to fly away. You don't think of the possibilities that you will win better friends, that you can be yourself around if you just stand your ground. And so you see a lot of people will cuck, basically, or retreat under pressure. Yes. They'll do something courageous, they'll do something honest, and then they'll retreat. It's very sad to see that for the simple reason that it discourages other people from doing the same.
Yes. Yes, it does. And it never helps.
It never helps.
The thing is that you never gain your enemies or opponents' respect by backing down and showing subservience to them. And so you lose the respect of your friends and your enemies. You don't gain any new friends. And your enemies will just think even less of you.
Yes.
You know? And you're not fooling anyone except maybe some of your friends.
Yeah. Usually our people only manage to fool themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the sad result of just engaging in fakery and dissimulation. You only fool yourself. You only fool your own people. You never fool your enemies because they're masters of dissimulation anyway. So let's talk about Oslo.
Yes. So the second event, the second Scans of Forum event, I'm going to speak at other events as well, but the second Scans of Forum event coming up is in Oslo on November 2nd. And this is our second time in Oslo. It's also our second time in Copenhagen, by the way. But yeah, this is our second time in Oslo, and the topic that we are going to talk about is human biodiversity. Now, human biodiversity is basically the suggestion that human behavior, or let's say diversity among and between human individuals and populations, have a significant biological basis, and they are heritable traits. Significantly heritable traits. And this would seem to be a very common sense position to defend and to suggest. But the fact is that in our popular culture, I mean, we have to make a sort of a distinction between the scientific community and the popular culture, because only a small part of what goes on in the scientific community gets out to the wider public through journalists, and journalists choose who they want to interview. Right? So if we talk about differences in personality traits, psychological differences, differences in IQ and so on, the research is quite clear, you know, that there are such differences between populations. But popular culture and you know, mainstream politics and so on wants you to believe or seems to suggest that such differences are only sort of man-made or made up or sort of just a function of social norms or whatever. So there's this life or this lifelong this history long debate about nature versus nurture, or nature and nurture, where nature represents the heritability of traits, genetic factors influencing behavior and so on. And nurture is the social, is your environment, it's your upbringing, it's your whatever you cultivate and so on. And basically the impression you get from popular culture today is that nature doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the heritable part of human nature doesn't matter. It's all, you know, socially constructed. We basically, modern society, more than anything else, I've suggested this repeatedly, that modern liberal society, more than anything else, is based on the axiom of the blank slate. That is the ideological, philosophical, metaphysical, and anthropological assumption that all liberal politics is based on. That we are blank slates and we can make decisions about what we want to be and what kind of society we want to create. And there is no human nature to put limits on that. You know, and therefore we can just move people from one place to another and it doesn't matter because everything is just, all differences are just very superficial.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this paradox that although the theory of evolution is just assumed and taken for granted and accepted in all of Western society, in the mainstream, it doesn't apply to humans. So basically we are supposed to accept that there is this magical distinction between animal society and biological society. And then when humans start, evolution stops and there is this limited creationism going on.
Right.
So basically, so and so many thousands of years ago, a creationist act or a sort of divine creation happened where you know, humans, Homo sapiens, were separated from the rest of biological life on Earth, and they now play under different rules because now they are all identical. And that doesn't...
I never thought of that before. A limited creationism.
That's yeah, it is. It is.
It's creationism from the neck up.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah.
The brain is somehow this magical wonderland that's infinitely malleable and transformable by means of culture.
Exactly.
But, everything else is evolved.
Exactly. And the thing is that, you know, if you just think about it for a little moment, you understand that that's just silly. So, yeah. I mean, it's liberalism, Marxism, socialism, whatever, the modern, in a very generic sense, left, which is the complete modern paradigm, it rejects Christianity. And Christianity has this sort of creationist underpinnings with you know, the creation of the Bible and so on, that the earth is less than 10,000 years and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this discussion between creationists, Christians, on one hand, and the sort of atheists or scientifically minded people on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the mainstream is solidly on the atheist and scientific side. But as soon as it comes to people, we can just throw all that out and there are no evolutionary differences between human populations that have been separated for tens and tens of thousands of years and have evolved in radically different environments. And we're supposed to believe that that doesn't affect the brain, which is like the most important organ we have.
And of course, the main reason to think, the main reason why we theorize that there are radical innate differences in the brains of these people is because when you look at the products of their civilizations,
mm-hmm.
if they have them at all,
they're
so radically different.
Yeah.
That's the phenomenon that leads us to speculate about differences, biological heritable differences that affect outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, some people build rockets and send them to the moon and others don't.
Others
don't even learn how to smelt iron or...
Oh, they build huts out of cow dung.
Yeah, things like that. So these are just... these are amazing differences in behavior and culture that need to be explained somehow. And the liberal answer is that, well, it's just a matter of culture and we can all reprogram these people.
Yeah.
We can reprogram them so they'll all be, you know, driving Buicks to the moon.
Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, it's not always clear whether these people actually believe that everyone is biologically identical or if they just maintain that it's not ethical to say out loud what you actually know to be true. That is, you know, left-leaning scientists have indicated as much that it might be true, but we're not supposed to include that in how we reason about society and what
it's double thing. Because on one hand, they'll say that, yes, we're all biologically the same, yet these are the same people who want to celebrate, you know, multiculturalism and the diversity of different civilizations, not recognizing that one contradicts the other.
Right.
If we're all biologically the same, then how did all these different civilizations come about? Which I think is, you know, a point that's been made, is that ultimately globalization and multiculturalism, for now they're directed at us, but if nothing changes, eventually it's going to be turned against all the other traditions as well, and there'll just be this commercial monoculture. Mm-hmm. And all these things that these people claim to admire in other civilizations will go away as well.
Yes. Yeah, and the interesting thing is that whenever this issue comes up, the left, so to speak, I always use that generically because people know what I'm talking about, their reaction is not to present science or arguments for why this conclusion is wrong. Their reaction is always, without exception, a witch hunt.
Yes.
To say that this person is bad, this is completely unacceptable, get this person fired. And I brought up James Watson earlier. James Watson is probably one of the most famous scientists over the last century. And he won the Nobel Prize in the 60s for research on, you know, groundbreaking research on the DNA. So he knows a thing or two about heritability and so on, genetics. And there was an interview in 2005 where he said to a journalist in a newspaper that he is generally gloomy about the prospects of Africa because all policies are based on the assumption that they have the same intelligence as us, whereas all the research shows that they don't. I mean, that's what he said, and
yeah.
For everyone who knows anything about the research, that will just be, you know, that will just be a true statement. That is what the research shows.
Right.
But the reaction was an outrage from people. I mean, okay, understand that this is a Nobel Prize winner. This is a biologist. This is a person who knows the research. And the journalists are not as familiar with the research as he is. But still, the reaction is that this is unacceptable, and the result is a witch hunt. And in 2014, he sold his Nobel gold medal because he had been ostracized from the scientific community because you must not say that.
Right.
He couldn't believe. And that is just one clear example. But I mean, there are so many where people have just spoken their minds, because that's the interesting thing about scientists who are very, you know, they're focused on their subject and they just say, well, this is just how it is. And sometimes they forget about what you're supposed to pretend in modern society, and they don't pretend. And oh, there's an outrage. And
yeah.
That must be contained somehow by these apostles of modern ideology, which is the journalists.
We need to give a Galileo award to scientists who cross the boundaries of political correctness get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Just to thank them for their courage and their sacrifice. Because these are people, of course, who make progress possible.
Yeah.
You have to go up against false dogmas in order to make scientific progress possible. And of course, your average liberal is all for evolution. They're on the right side of the Scopes monkey trial and all that other stuff. They're on the right side of Galileo and Giordano Bruno and all those things. But then they immediately turn into the papacy, into the witch burners, the low IQ Bible thumping, you know, creationist types.
Yeah.
On a dime.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of fascinating. It'd be nice to confront these people with how unseemly that all is, and try and raise their ability to introspect a bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who believe that, yes, there are scientific facts that can't be denied, but they still want to say it's immoral. And one version of that, it's immoral to talk about inherited differences And the one version of that I can think of is the sort of radical individualist view. They say, well, yes, we can look at these different bell curves, right? Mm-hmm. But those just apply to groups. We have to deal with individuals, and therefore we have to treat every individual as if he is indeed an individual. We owe that to everybody. Mm-hmm. We owe them that debt of justice to treat each individual as an individual. And I've argued in my essay in Defense of Prejudice that that's simply a moralistic absurdity, because you simply can't treat every individual as an individual. And you don't make social policy mm-hmm. based on individuals. You make social policy based on big numbers.
Of course.
And averages. And when you ask whether a given white and a given black are compatible with one another, well, they might be outliers, and they might be very, very similar, indeed compatible. Mm-hmm. But that's not how you make social policy. When you make social policy, you take the two bell curves and you look at them side by side and you think, there is such a distinction here between average amounts of IQ or sociopathy or whatever thing you're measuring. There are lots and lots of traits that distribute themselves on bell curves. Mm-hmm. These groups are too incompatible mm-hmm. to expect anything but conflict if you put them together in the same social system mm-hmm. on conditions of equality. But there are people who want to basically say, no, it's immoral per se to mm-hmm. think about collectives and their mm-hmm. compatibility. We all have to live in this world of unique special snowflakes. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is an argument that you get, but it's an argument that really can't stand up.
No.
And when you get right down to it, the people who believe this stuff don't believe in government anyway. So they don't believe in social policy or what's necessary to make social policy. And you just have to, at a certain point, you just have to say, we're not going to listen to you. Mm-hmm. This is a charming eccentricity and aberration that you can only afford to pretend to practice. in a very special kind of society, we'd be foolish to listen to this in making policies. So that's the end of that.
Yeah, and there is a clear trend. I mean, if you really go into the details, Marxists, in a wide sense, there is a deep trend among Marxist intellectuals, professors, scientists, whatever, that the proper function of science is not to describe reality, but to change it. And that's one of the foundations of Marxism, Marx's idea about philosophy and so on.
To change human nature.
And if you really get down to the details, you can find these admissions from left-leaning scientists that they see science as an ideological weapon.
Yeah,
to change society. And they often admit that, well, there might well be evolutionary differences and biological differences, but for ideological reasons, we are not supposed to talk about them. We are supposed to pretend that they don't exist, because that is the ideology.
The reason why most people don't believe in global warming, anthropogenetic global warming, is because it's so obvious that the people who are pushing this have political agendas and are engaged in some kind of highly engaged propaganda from a far left globalist point of view. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so scientists will lie about this kind of stuff. Yeah. And my answer to the people who think that, well, we can change the races is, yes, we can change the races. We can change them through eugenics. Mm-hmm. Of course, they don't want to talk about that. No. We can change the races by giving Africans 100,000 years of evolution in a very cold climate. Mm-hmm. I'd say 100,000 years of evolution in a cold climate might make our bell curves sort of match up pretty much. But of course they don't want to do that. They think that they can change reality simply by changing the way people talk about
mm-hmm. yes.
The different groups.
Words.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was, you know, the famous Pavlov's dog experiment, where you know, he would ring a bell every time he fed the dog, and then found that, you know, when he rang the bell and didn't give the dog food, you know, it would start salivating. That was actually conducted in the Soviet Union because they were trying to prove that people could be conditioned to accept communism in accordance with Marxist doctrine.
Yes. Yeah, so this is what we're going to talk about in Oslo. And we're going to break those taboos. We're not going to, you know, keep to the taboos of what we're supposed to talk about and not. And the interesting thing is that if you just sort of, if you just look at the popular debate, the popular culture, popular mass media debate, you would get the impression that science about races, differences about among races, between races, differences between men and women, science about that, research about that, has all been refuted after the Second World War, and it's all junk science, and we can just leave that behind us, and now we're in a brighter future, and that's not science anymore. Where, like I suggested earlier, this science has been going on all the time. And this is good. I mean, this research happens all the time at universities. It's just that our journalists, mainstream journalists, choose to not interview those researchers. They choose to interview someone else. And so it's not true. I mean, this has not been refuted in any way. And the research is going strong. And we have invited some of those people who do this research to this conference, and that's the good thing.
So who are the speakers in Oslo?
So this is going to be a bit more of an academic conference than our previous ones, and I guess that I'm the only one who doesn't have a PhD in something. So, of course, Greg, you have a PhD in philosophy. We have Edward Dutton, who he has actually a PhD in theology, but what he does research on is the anthropology of religion.
Mm-hmm.
So although he started out in religion, he is more in the hard sciences end of things, namely how does religion affect, you know, the people, what kind of people, and you know, with evolutionary factors, and how does religion stand in relation to what is adaptable behavior and not, and so on. And he has done intelligence research, and he is also the editor of Mankind Quarterly, an old publication that has a high standing in our circles, I would say.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
It goes back, I think, at least to the 1950s.
Yeah, it's old, and it's very sort of. That's where you can find the interesting research of today.
Yeah, a lot of it.
So he's going to speak, and that's going to be very good. He also has a very nice YouTube channel called The Jolly Heretic, where he talks about all kinds of interesting things. And then we also have Helmut Nyborg, who is a Danish professor emeritus from Aalborg University. He has done lots of research on intelligence and heritable differences in intelligence and behavior and so on. And he's also been very vocal and active in this debate that I'm describing, basically about bias in the academy.
Right.
Bias in the academic world. And he's going to talk about that subject. He's going to talk about nature, nurture, and bias in the academy. And that's going to be a very interesting talk, because he has, you know, he has worked with Richard Binn and other, you know, very well-known names, and he has done a lot of good research. And then we have Kevin MacDonald. Everyone listening to this probably knows who Kevin MacDonald is. He is a professor emeritus of psychology in California, and he has written four books, if you include an anthology as well, about Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy, but he is going to talk more about his newer research, more regarding us, rather than looking at the Jews as a group from an evolutionary standpoint. He has taken a look at us, Europeans, North Europeans, and Indo-Europeans, and tried to describe and tried to figure out how come we have these weird traits, such as pathological altruism and so on, that can be exploited by opponents to basically undermine us. How come we are so naive and have this sort of totalitarian liberalism? How come that is a North European thing more than anything else? So he has published some excerpts from his upcoming book, and he's going to talk about those topics as well. So those are the speakers, and that's going to be a very interesting conference. I'm very much looking forward to it.
So how did the idea of the Scanza Forum come about? And how many Scanza Forum meetings have there been so far? And before the Scanza Forum per se actually came about, you were involved in organizing other events too. So can you talk a little bit about the prehistory of Scanza Forum?
I can, yeah. I guess I didn't have any plan at all to become a sort of a conference organizer or organizer of any kind. But I think you and I, Greg, were talking because we've been friends and we've been, you know, in touch for many years. And you were talking about a trip to Europe. You were going to Europe for a while and we were talking about that. And I said, well, I know you have many readers in Sweden. So you should just come here to Sweden and we should organize an event so you can meet readers and so on. And you agreed to do that. And then I thought, well, if we have one person, why not get some more speakers and we can have a proper event? So I invited Kevin MacDonald. I invited actually Jonas Diar. You two had a debate about Christianity and the future of the West. And we also had Mark Weber. Mm-hmm. And we also had Ricardo Duchesne. Mm-hmm. So it was a really sort of all-star lineup of speakers at a very spontaneous event that I really hadn't planned to, you know, to be. It was just like a spontaneous thing. And that was a success. That was a huge success. It was a really good event. So people wanted more of that. I had planned it as just like a one-off thing. I organized this together with my friends in Logik Förlag in Sweden. Publishing company in Sweden, and we got a lot of good feedback. Actually, it just so happened, I didn't do this intentionally, but that event was on the very same day as AMREN in America. So I have to apologize to Jared Taylor, because I didn't know that at the time, but people who came to the event said that, you know what, I plan on going to AMREN, but considering this list of speakers, I canceled that and I came here instead.
That was in April of 2015, right?
Yeah, that was April 20th, 2015.
Jared doesn't have trouble getting people.
No, he doesn't. So but I wasn't aware until people told me at the very event that, you know, AMREN is today as well. I didn't know that. That was just a coincidence. But I'm sure that AMREN was a success anyway. That was fun, but we got a lot of good feedback and, you know, people wanted more of these events. So I decided that, okay, let's throw one more. And we did it again in Stockholm in September 2015, mm-hmm. also together with Logik Förlag. And then I thought, you know, I've already done this now, let's move on, do something else. Mm-hmm. But people continued to contact me, they liked it a lot, so... during 2016, I did other things and so on. And in early 2017, I decided to, well, I enjoy doing these things. And they actually have a lot of value for people. Mm-hmm. Because people come there, they interact, they start projects after that, they network, they, you know, a lot of things are born out of people meeting at events like that. And I enjoy it. I enjoy doing it. So in early 2017, I started the Scanza Forum just to have like a proper structure for this whole thing and to build a brand around it and build a sort of, so people know what they get basically. So people know about it. And we had our first Scanza Forum in Stockholm in 2017 and... What month was it? I think it was May.
It was May.
Yeah. May 2017. That was in Stockholm. And then we went to Oslo, to Norway, and had just a month later, the 1st of July, we had our first conference in Norway. Mm-hmm. And basically, Sweden has a long tradition of these things. These things have been happening, you know, organized by different people throughout the years in Sweden. It's not a big deal. I mean, what we're doing is popular and is nice and good, but it has a history there. But in Sweden, in Norway and in Denmark, it was a bit more groundbreaking in a way, I think, because people were coming and lots of new people were appearing in these events. So Oslo was a good thing. We had Mike Enoch on for the first time outside of America. That was his first European event. We had lots of, you know, laureates. We had a friend of mine, Olof Olav Thorheim, and Millennial Woes. It was a very good event. And then the year after that, we went back to Sweden, and that was last year. So 2018, we had another event in Sweden, and then we had an event in September in Denmark. September 2018, we had a conference in Copenhagen with Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor was also in Stockholm, so he spoke at two of our conferences in 2018. We had one more conference in Stockholm earlier this year. I think that was in April. Mm-hmm. And now we're doing Norway and Copenhagen, not Norway and Denmark again. So we're having conferences in all three Scandinavian countries during 2019.
So yeah, you've gone up from two a year now to three a year,
basically. Yeah, we've increased the pace, and you know, we need to go back to Denmark and we need to go back to Norway.
Yeah.
Because nothing else is really going on there on the level that we want it to be, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Denmark has a lot of national populist things going on. Norway is kind of dead in many ways, the sort of thing. I mean, they have the same problems, but they don't really have a debate about them. So we need to get things going in those two countries as well.
Yeah. And in those cases, the forums are kind of investments. They're kind of loss leader investments. It's a bit risky to do these things because in Sweden, you've got a fairly large crowd that you can pretty much count on showing up if things are timed right and so forth. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Oslo and in Copenhagen, it's a little more of a dicey situation.
It is.
And one thing that I encourage people who want to help Skanza to do is donate to Skanza Forum to help with the costs of that, because it is a kind of missionary work that we're engaged in, or they're engaged in. I say we because I've been at all the Skanza Forum events, and the reason I've been at all of them is, well, because you've invited me, but also because I believe in it strongly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I forgive me if I sometimes take ownership of it, but it's very important to do these things in places that have not had these sorts of events before, because that might be the first time that 8 or 10 or 20 or 40 people in Copenhagen will be in the same room, and that might be the beginning of all kinds of nationalist organizing in that country. The same thing with Norway. Mm-hmm. It would be fun to do smaller events maybe in Iceland. Mm-hmm. And, Iceland is a very small country, mm-hmm. but it would be very interesting to try something there maybe someday.
That would be cool. I mean, Iceland is very expensive.
Yeah.
And that is sort of a bit of a limit, but it would be interesting just to do it. And I definitely have that ambition. Skanza is, the name Skanza comes from Jordanes, a 5th or 6th century East Roman historian who wrote about the history of the Goths, the Gothic people. And he used the word Skanza to describe, you know, Norway and Sweden. It's the oldest version we have of the word Scandinavia.
Right.
So that's like a sacred term. This is because, I don't know, you know, what people outside of Scandinavia know and people outside of Europe and so on, Americans, but Scandinavia is very interconnected. The destiny of Scandinavia is very much interconnected. So we share a common destiny. We share a common language, I would say, even though not everyone in Sweden understands everyone in Norway and so on. But I would say it's the same language, originally speaking, and we have the same sort of history, the same mythology, with the same religious backgrounds, the same ethnicity, very closely related Scandinavians are. And yeah, Iceland is definitely an extension of Scandinavia because it was populated by Norwegian Vikings in the 800s. So it's a continuation of Scandinavia in the same way that America is a continuation of, you know, Europe in that sense, because it's like, so yeah, it's definitely a part of our mission.
Yeah.
I would say.
Greenland?
Probably, maybe not. I
don't know. The Faroe Islands.
Greenland, yeah. Not so much.
Not so much. Yeah. It's a different thing altogether.
Yeah. Well, this has been a really good conversation. We've been going at it for an hour now. Is there anything you'd like to add, and particularly sort of to get the hook in people and get them to do something. Let's end with an action item for the listeners out there. What can people do to attend the Scanza Forum, support the Scanza Forum, etc.?
Good, yeah. I mean, I think that many people are just in the safety of their homes listening to these things. But it is a liberating thing to go out there and meet other people, and you can sort of let your shoulders down because you can live truthfully, and it's interesting, and you get to know a lot of good people. And I'm definitely fortunate to be a part of this whole thing where I interact with people that I enjoy interacting with, and I don't have to pretend. So the thing, if you want to participate, send me an email, info@scanzaforum.com. The announcement for both events are up on the Countercurrents front page, I believe. And if you send me an email, remember to include two things. First of all, which event do you want to attend? Copenhagen or Oslo or both? The second thing is the vetting information. So remember to write if you have been at a previous event, if you know someone who can vouch for you, or send me photo ID because I need to know who is coming. And that's for the safety of the participants, the integrity of the event, the safety of the speakers, everything. And we're going to have a very good time. And we also have, after the events, after the speeches are done, we have a little social gathering as well. And that's also very fun. So please send me an email and stay in touch.
Thank you very much.